AI and machine learning are major talking points inside and outside of the biotech industry.
Well, Dodi, I've been under a rock, so I have no idea what we're talking about. Do you think that's possibly true?
I think that's so untrue because you are obsessed.
I am,
and
indeed.
I know you're going to enjoy this episode. AI and biotech is what matters today on Discovery Matters. Let's set the stage with our first guest, Dr. Namshik Han.
My journey into this AI technology for biomedical research is driven by deep-seated belief in the transformative power of machine learning and computational strategies to advance patient journey and also patient care and also therapeutics discovery. So I'm the head of computational research and AI at the Miller Therapeutics Institute, Cambridge University. And also I have two other affiliations. One is to Cambridge Center for Medicine and Mathematics Department. And the other one is to Wellcome Trust MRC Stem Cell Institute in Cambridge University. So my all activities in this university is to develop and also apply the bespoke and specialized AI to dissect and also investigate the complex multimodal biomedical data sets.
Namshik is linking theoretical computational methods with practicality. He wants to revolutionize how we actually understand disease mechanisms and how we approach drug discovery. Integrating AI could help identify drug targets and streamline patient care and personalize, big word there, personalize treatment strategy.
That sounds pretty exciting. So what about an example of where this understanding of huge data sets has led to a breakthrough?
Globally, AI has been instrumental in several groundbreaking discoveries in disease pathways and mechanisms, as you said. An AI algorithm has been able to predict the function of genes and their roles in the disease, which is the kind of real example that a human genome usually consists of nearly 20,000 genes. So for example, Alzheimer, where AI has helped identify new potential biomarkers and therapeutic targets by analyzing complex patterns in data that human researchers might overlook. So these discoveries are invaluable as they can lead earlier diagnostics and also in intervention strategy. So this is one of the things. Also in cardiology, there are a few good examples, like AI has been very important to predict heart disease using imaging data or EKG results and other health records more accurately than some traditional risk models. These instances are just a snapshot of profound impact of AI across the broader biomedical research. The speed and efficiency and the precision that AI brings into the data analysis are unmatched and is enabling discoveries at the pace and scale we never seen before.
So there's a mistrust element sometimes when it comes to artificial intelligence. Do they express fear to Namshik? How does he talk about it to them?
AI, at the level of really highly advanced, even though we have really, really outstanding and exciting prediction results, the problem is no one can actually explain the results. So that's myself and my group as well, but also many other groups and many other companies are really working on explainable AI or another way, interpretable AI. So building the trust is really important. By doing this kind of so-called white box technology, so white box means we can really look into the machine and mechanism and how actually this machine can predict this type of results so that we can actually properly interpret these computational predictions, in our case, into the biomedical clinical context. So we don't always giving just like top kind of 10, let's say, target list to our collaborator, like companies, but we are trying to explain why this has to be the top 10. However, if we are thinking about the kind of drug approval from a regulatory body like FDA, this is really important to explain the mechanism of action to them. And also number of other cases in real kind of clinical setting, clinical decision support is paramount. So to the human doctors, sometimes it's really important to help them to make a decision. However, if the black box cannot explain the reason why the human doctor need to choose this decision, then it's quite difficult. However, if we can provide this kind of interpretation from the computational prediction to a biomedical setting, then possibly it's much easier to make decision making.
So basically, AI can be seen as an aid to human decision making. It's going to help the decision, but it won't make the decision. So when we think about this in the clinical setting or drug discovery, how is it going to help optimize those stages and speed the development of new therapies for these diseases?
AI has really the potential to streamline and enhance clinical trial optimization. Also really important for many pharma companies because this is kind of very costly process and time-consuming, but more importantly, for the patient and their families, it's really important. It's not just about money and time. So in terms of clinical trial design, possibly AI can help to find the best and correct and right patient group. So patient selection is paramount. AI is now heavily used on the target identification and also virtually screen some compound sets, and also predictive modeling is really helpful to understand how this drug could have effects or safety issues. And recently, there is another emerging field called drug repurposing, but nowadays many big companies now working on. So one of the examples could be, again, data mining. So possibly AI can mine existing medical data and find new use of the drugs that are already on the market. So identifying potential drug disease relationship that have not been considered before. And these AI-driven approaches have the potential to significantly reduce the time and cost associated with bridging new therapy to market. So providing patients with faster access, I think, to life-saving treatment is a really advancement.
Specifically, AI proves its value to Namshik and team when it comes to multimodal biomedical data sets.
Multimodal biomedical data refers to diverse type of data that can be collected from various biological and clinical sources. So as we discussed, it's including genomics, DNA sequencing data, and of course the transcriptomics from messenger RNAs and sometimes epigenetics data from the long non-coding RNAs. But more importantly, I think recently also metabolomics and proteomics is really important on top of medical imaging data sets. So one of the way we are using AI is data integration. So this is very important to how we can systematically and unsupervisingly integrate those data sets. And secondly, once we have it, of course, the second one is pattern recognition. So this is kind of a term in machine learning. However, this is also quite important to find the pattern. In this context means like maybe it's a gene expression pattern that impact potential kind of production of proteins in the patient group versus like a normal healthy individuals. And also we are using some natural language processing because, I mean, there are tons of information at the moment in the literature, also in the pattern databases. So we are actually using machine learning powered up to the natural language processing to really automatically and systematically mine the data and information in this literature. And also we are really interested in the predictive models and unsupervised learning. It's because we wanted to see something that we never seen before. So for example, AlphaGo is one of the very first kind of breakthrough maybe in modern current AI domain, which made by DeepMind, and AlphaGo beat the human champion number of times. And after that, many people analyze it. Of course, one of the concerns is like the big problem is that DeepMind cannot explain how the machine really played the Go that very well. However, also in some more positive way, some people saying, oh, the AlphaGo played the Go in the way that none of the human players played before. So that means possibly we might also using this kind of unsupervised learning or deep learning to see some kind of novel targets that human researchers never thought of or never seen before, so that we might find really innovative, novel target in this domain. So that's actually what we are aiming for and we are working for.
So where does Namshik think AI can really help us in the future? Is it like a particular disease area or a type of disease that we can really make progress with?
I'm a very optimistic person, so I do see there is a kind of real potential in number of areas. One of them has a huge potential in accelerate the drug discovery pipelines. So hopefully we will see some more innovative, novel drugs in number of high medical need areas. And also everyone says personalized medicine. So hopefully we will reach that stage. And also a few others like improved diagnostics accuracy, meaning we can early detect the cancer or other disease, meaning even we don't need any therapy, we can prevent the disease in very, very early stage. All of this specialized AI technology are really set to revolutionize healthcare by making it more productive and proactive, personalized and more efficient, and ultimately leading to an era where new therapies are really developed and deployed more rapidly and efficiently across a range of diseases.
From multimodal data to multidisciplinary work with transplant patients, let's meet someone new on this angle of AI in biotech.
My name is Kurusha Parsi. I'm a professor of transplant surgery at the University of Cambridge, and I also run a research program at the university that's focused on better understanding diseases, complex disorders such as cancer. I also have a passion about clinical translation of my discoveries and technologies, including through forming biotech companies and commercialization of those strategies. So I have founded a number of companies related to this space.
So how did Kurush get into this field?
I did always want to become a doctor. Once I was going through medical school, I do distinctly remember the first time that I went into the operating theater and observed my first operation. And actually, at that point, it was very clear to me that I wanted to become a surgeon. But by that time, I'd also started a research degree to study for a PhD, and I wanted to be able to continue my research and combine it with my clinical practice in transplantation. Was an excellent opportunity for that. It was clear to me that many of the questions that we were answering in transplantation were also relevant to other diseases such as cancer or cellular therapies. Being a clinician, to me, it is absolutely essential that we ensure that our work, our discoveries, our science impacts patients. So really the ultimate measure of benefit is, are patients' lives saved? Are patients' lives made better? And oftentimes we are in a situation where we have to take charge of that clinical translation. In other words, translating our discoveries from the bedside to the bedside. And that has been my motivation forming the companies that I work with, because that is a vehicle for ensuring that these discoveries ultimately result in patient benefit. I find all of these hats that I wear are very much synergistic and support each other. So not only they don't detract from each other, but really they are all on point or focused on the ultimate aim of trying to play a small part in hopefully making patients' lives better.
So AI is really increasingly becoming a tool for multidisciplinary work.
Gone are the days where problems could be solved by individuals with single domain expertise. So absolutely, the approach needs to be multidisciplinary in all of these. Within the healthcare system, technologies are now emerging that allow us to generate vast amounts of data, much more so than we have been able to do historically. And that gives us an opportunity to really better understand how diseases arise and identify potential new therapeutics or ways of predicting how patients will respond. But the challenge that comes with this vast quantities of data being available or being generated is that we need a robust and well-structured strategy for analyzing this data. Now, this itself raises a challenge because researchers like myself, either academically or commercially, we are now generating large amounts of data. So we are now looking at supplementing the expertise in our teams by recruiting machine learning specialists, AI specialists, bioinformaticians. So for example, in my laboratory group, I now have two bioinformaticians that are jointly supervised by somebody who's an expert in that area. Now, I'm a biologist, and therefore I'm not an expert in machine learning, but I personally feel that I need to have a better high-level understanding in order to make sure that I use these approaches most appropriately. So in fact, I last month completed a distance learning course myself at MIT focused on data science and machine learning. Not because I need to be doing that day in and day out, but I need to communicate better. I need to understand the terminology better in order to be more effective as a collaborator in these programs.
And thus does the teacher become a student. Remarkable.
And Kurush is constantly learning from those around him.
The way that we are constructing these multidisciplinary teams is to partner with people who are domain experts in machine learning or bioinformatics or actually any other area, and actually empower those people in those groups to lead those areas. So it makes no sense for me to tell the bioinformaticians what to do. I need to understand what they do. I need to be able to provide biological insight, but they are the domain experts. So they need to then have the ability to actually advise me and the rest of the team on what to do. So I think we need to also, in these multidisciplinary teams and approaches, particularly relevant also to AI, is to sort of move away from this the classical hierarchical mindset whereby there's somebody sits at the top of the group, they're the expert in every area and tell everybody else what to do. I think that's how we can be much more effective in solving these complex problems.
So Kurush begins by outlining the importance of patient-centric work. How does he then see AI delivering better personalized medicine?
There is been a lot of discussion and anticipation as far as personalized delivery of healthcare is concerned. But in truth, most of the healthcare that we deliver currently is not truly personalized. It's stratified. What I mean by that is typically we have one or two questions that we ask. Does this particular patient's tumor cells express this particular receptor, yes or no? And if it's a yes, they get one treatment. If it's a no, they get another treatment. Right. Well, that is one level of personalization, but hopefully listeners will agree that that's quite crude. True personalization would be if we asked 10 questions or maybe 100 questions or 1,000 questions about the tumor, and then we had a combination of dozens, if not hundreds, of treatment options available. So within transplantation, similar problems exist. What I mean by that is, as a general rule, transplantation is a very effective therapy, but we have a sort of a typically a one-size-fits-all approach to, for example, the use of immunosuppression or the other treatments patients get, how we preserve organs for longer periods of time in order to be able to do transplantation.
These are examples where machine learning approaches could help with personalization, but check this out. Machine learning could help improve preservation of organs. What?
When we retrieve an organ from a deceased organ donor and there's informed consent, let's say a liver or a pancreas, and then we cool this organ down, we flush it with a preservation solution. Now, we tend to use exactly the same preservation solution for example, every liver. And we don't take into account the nuances of the biology of that particular organ and that whether it is more or less susceptible to injury or more or less susceptible to prolonged preservation. So we have one preservation solution, if you like, one drug that we use for all those organs. Actually, it may be that some organs will be able to tolerate preservation for a longer period or shorter period, or they may need different drugs added. That's an example of a personalized strategy to preservation of organs that we are working on, again, in combination of one of the companies that I work with in the US called Revalia Bio. So we are looking at, can we personalize even this process, which is an important step within transplantation?
Here, AI and personalization are helping challenge long-held assumptions about how we cater to biology.
As a field of clinicians, we have our favorite preservation solution, and that's going to work for all livers. But remember that there is so much variation or heterogeneity, not just in our individual patients, but also in the context of transplantation in the organs that we receive. These are not perfect organs. They have endured a life in that donor, right? There will be some background level of disease. They may be affected by things like the weight of that patient, or whether they were smoking, or whether they had consumed alcohol, or whether they have diabetes, right? So for us to make the assumption that none of these details matter in terms of how that organ endures injury, I think it's too simplistic and it's likely to prove to be incorrect. We aim to generate and capture as much data as possible, both related to the donor, but also what's going on in that organ, using specialized tools that allow us to generate high levels of detail about what's happening at the level of the cells in that organ, what's happening at the level of the DNA or the RNA or the proteins. Now we have a very rich data set that we can correlate with the information we have about that patient, the information we have about what happens when that organ is transplanted, and then start thinking about personalized delivery of healthcare.
As AI has tested and challenged the assumptions of clinicians, what has surprised Karush the most?
We've made some assumptions historically in the past about how disease occurs. So your listeners would be familiar, even those who are not biologists, that we've assumed for many years that mutations in human cells are the sort of the key event that leads to generation of cancer. So that we have cells that get one or two important mutations, and then these result in the growth of the cells becoming dysregulated or out of control. And then these cells grow too much and they form tumors or cancers. Now, once we've started looking at some of the data that we're generating from healthy human samples, we started to realize that actually healthy cells, including those that have no evidence of cancer, also have a lot of these mutations. Even if we take healthy cells from a patient's esophagus, so that's the gullet, that's the food pipe. So we can take healthy cells from a patient's esophagus, and we can take cancer cells from somebody who's got esophageal cancer. When we compare those, we find that actually both of them have a lot of the same common mutations. And that's the same case with every tissue we've looked at. So what this is starting to challenge is this simple story that just mutations lead to cancer. It tells us that, well, mutations are important, but they're not the whole story. They're one piece of the jigsaw puzzle. But what else is important? Maybe it's what's happening at the level of the messenger RNA, so some of the signaling molecules. So we've started to generate this data at very large scale.
Karush and his company are now trying to generate very large scales of high quality data. And that kind of bulk is just impossible to analyze without the use of sophisticated machine learning and artificial intelligence.
So this is super exciting. Does he have an area which he feels is like the most promising?
I think the most promising area is for disease discovery or disease mechanisms, discovering how changes in human cells and human organs lead to diseases, so better understanding of disease, and then finding novel, more effective therapies. We're also using AI for diagnostic purposes, for example, doing analysis of CT scans or other imaging, or looking at slides of tissues that need to be looked at to diagnose, for example, presence of cancer and so on. A number of current applications and then exciting future applications as far as discovery of new therapeutics are concerned.
So the possibilities are immense. Where does he stand on the kind of the uncanny valley, the fear element of AI?
Well, like Namshik, Karush is buoyed by the helping hand of AI. And actually, like yourself, Connor, you are buoyed by the exciting potential of AI.
I think it's going to help us do things. I mean, you know, we joke that I welcome our new AI overlords, but in many ways, you know, we're not doing a great job of humaning. So perhaps we could get some help from machines that are a little bit less emotional in how they respond to things.
My overall sort of message for the listeners would be to be open-minded and embrace the new opportunities and that technologies such as AI and machine learning bring to the society. But importantly, also be inquisitive and be challenging and question these and ensure that those who are using these technologies are responsible, are transparent, and ultimately have the patients in their focus.
Today, we uncovered the incredible potential of artificial intelligence to revolutionize biomedical research, leading to groundbreaking discoveries in neurological diseases, Alzheimer's, for example, predicting heart diseases more accurately than traditional risk models, optimizing drug discovery and development, and facilitating better transplants, personalized treatment strategies. So those are the pluses on the side of AI, and those are pretty powerful.
They are. They're powerful. And, you know, as with all new technologies, it takes a while for us to get used to what the opportunity is. There's fear as they come along. There's always a worry that it's going to drive, you know, job losses and so on. But every new technology that's ever been introduced until now, humans have learned to live with. And we've had the ethics catch up with the technology in a way that actually helps us use it to its best effect. So I'm very positive and encouraged by the progress that we're making here.
Of course you are.
And so now to our Every Day is a School Day section.
You go first. What have you learned recently?
I have learned something really quite fun and related to what we've been talking about today, actually, that AI can learn language through the experience of a single child. And it's a study that was published in Science where researchers developed a machine learning model that mimics the way children learn language. And that gives us new insights into how children learn language very early on. They used video and audio recordings from a device on a child's head, and the model was then able to successfully learn to associate words with visual objects, and that's something that really helps us understand the really quite mysterious process of how children begin to learn and use language. So that, for me, was just super exciting that, you know, machines can learn how we learn.
Exactly. But it makes me think of, you know, young kids who are learning several languages at one time. You're able to do that, I think, until the age of 7 or 8.
Exactly. They learn two sets of words. It's amazing,
harder.
Isn't it? Yeah.
That's right. Yeah. And kids are keenly aware of the audience they're speaking to. Like, they're able to look, for example, my best friend who was married to a Swede, her kids knew when they were looking at mom, they spoke English. When they were looking at dad, they spoke Swedish.
And they may not even have clearly understood that those were two separate languages. It's just that you use different words with mom and dad. And it's super interesting in multilingual families.
Yes, yeah. It is.
Fantastic. And it makes the brains of people who speak multiple languages and have learned them early on extremely plastic and, what's the word, agile. So, you know, if you're bilingual, you've got one up on the rest of us.
Yeah. Or even those who are trilingual, which is pretty incredible. Just incredible. What I learned also has to do with languages, but it's not spoken language. So this is a study from science.org that is looking at sign languages and how they are related and using computational methods, right? So again, with the machine learning and tracing the geographical patterns of where sign languages developed and how they related to each other.
Oh, how interesting. The same way you might like track a language like English or German or Spanish or what have you across geographies over time.
Yep.
Super interesting.
So they developed this model that found that word form properties were related, and the data from sign languages are helping them look at the patterns of languages, how they change over time and location. Pretty incredible to be able to do that with sign languages.
That's amazing. So I wonder if there's like a proto-Indo-European source sign language at the very beginning of it all.
Right.
You know, tens of thousands of years ago. Yeah. Could be really fun. Oh, what an interesting study. So there we go. Machine learning in language.
I think so. Can't say that I understand it deeply, but I was certainly fascinated to read the parts that I understood about it.
And if it isn't language that unites us. This has been a podcast from Discovery Matters. My name is Colin McKechnie. Rate us on whichever platform you use. Our producer is...
It's Beth Armit Brewster, and thanks to Beth for producing our episodes, and thanks to Banda Productions for the editing and mixing and supervision. Epidemic Sound provides the music that you hear under our voices. We'll be back soon with another episode of Discovery Matters. Thanks for listening.